Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Let's begin today with politics and a look at the extraordinary number of women running for office here in Massachusetts and across the country and what it portends for the coming midterm elections. A case in point, Lori Trahan, the Democratic candidate for Congress running to succeed Nikki Tsongas in the state's 3rd congressional district. Today, Trahan attended a Democratic unity event a day after she was finally declared the winner of that very close Democratic primary election 2 weeks ago. After an official recount, she beat her closest competitor, Dan Coe, who conceded yesterday by just 145 votes. Trahan will face Republican challenger Rick Green, and she says she's looking forward to making her case to voters.
We're going to keep talking about increasing access to health care that people can afford. You know, there's a rising cost of living that our wages are not keeping up with, an opioid crisis that's taking too many people in our community, and an immigration enforcement that's not humane and counter to our values.
Lori Trahan is, among other things, part of an unprecedented wave of female political candidates running in Massachusetts and across the country. Consider this. In the current congressional election cycle, 50% of non-incumbent Democratic House nominees are women. 50%. That eclipses the last record of 29% back in 2016. These candidates are fired up by a number of issues, including the policies of Donald Trump. But this is not only about the president. To talk more about this, we're joined by Dave Hopkins. He's a professor of political science at Boston College. He studies American political parties and elections. Good to have you.
Great to be here, Anthony.
Also with us from Washington, D.C. is Julie McLean Downey. She's National Director of Campaign Communications with Emily's List, which recruits and supports women candidates. Julie, good to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So, Dave, let me start with you. What are we seeing here in Massachusetts in terms of the number of women running for office this season? What's striking you?
Well, what we're seeing here is very much the story we're seeing across the country. Massachusetts is sort of part of this bigger trend of more Democratic women running for office and more Democratic women winning in Democratic primaries. And we just had two really big House primaries here in the state, up in the 3rd District, as we talked about, and then also closer in the 7th District, where we had this fairly historic upset of Ayanna Pressley beating a 10-term incumbent, Mike Capuano. And in both cases, we see new, younger women winning in Democratic primaries, and it's the same story really from coast to coast in 2018.
We can also go back to last November. 6 women of color elected to the Boston City Council. Outside of Boston, Ruth Ann Fuller was elected first female mayor of Newton. Yvonne Spicer became not only Framingham's first female chief executive, but the city's first mayor. So what explains this? Dave, let me stick with you. Why are women running and why are they winning?
Yeah, it's an interesting story with sort of both a supply and a demand side. The supply side is just record numbers of women candidates filing for office, running active campaigns, strong, very competitive women candidates that are just strong contenders in primaries more than ever before. But then I think there's another side of it, which is that Democratic voters are looking for women candidates more than they used to. They're weighing gender and they're more interested in rectifying the historic underrepresentation of women in office more this year than they have in the past. So it's both more women running and then more women winning votes in Democratic elections.
Julie McLean Downey, let me come to you. This dynamic, as Dave mentioned, is playing out across the country. Tell us how Emily's List sees this. What are you seeing just in terms of sheer numbers?
Yeah, well, to give you a sense for how unique this cycle is, Emily's List last election cycle, which is Election Day post-2014 through Election Day 2016, we had about 920 women reach out to Emily's List and say, I want to run for office. Can you help me do that? That was a very high number for us, and we called it the Hillary bump. This election cycle, since the day after election 2016 to today, we've had more than 40,000 women reach out to us.
40,000, from 900 to 40,000 in two
That's
years.
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, our organization has tripled the number of staff members we have working on down ballot races, because most of these women are not looking to run for governor tomorrow, but rather they are wanting to make running for office part of their long-term plans. They might not run this year, next year, or 4 years from now, but it's something that they have decided is important to them, and they want to be a voice for their community. So we saw this sort of wave of first-time candidates running for congressional office with a diversity of background and bringing unique qualifications to the jobs, including fighter pilots and former CIA operatives, nonprofit executives, these women with tremendous resumes stepping up to run, but also women just saying, I want to be a part of change in my community. At the more local level.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really up and down the ballot that we've seen this excitement about women running for office, both from the candidates themselves and also from voters.
And Julie, what's really fueling this? Is it all about Donald Trump or not?
It is not all about Donald Trump. I can say that with certainty. Having been in a lot of our candidate training rooms where we have women come and sort of spend a whole day with our staff learning about how to build a campaign, create a budget, I can tell you that they are not fans of Donald Trump. They are frustrated by Republican leadership, especially when it came to the health care battle. They did not like what they were seeing out of Washington. But that's not why they're running for school board or city council or mayor or water commissioner. They're running because they see this sort of dearth of good leadership and want to find a way to make a difference. Women, we always say at Emily's List, they don't run for office because they want to be something, but rather they want to do something.
I want to play a piece of tape. A few months back, I talked to Boston City Councilor Lydia Edwards right after she was elected there. And here's what she said about why so many women like her are running.
People are confusing with saying almost like this is the time for women, when in reality, women haven't run at this level before. Right. And so I hope that people see, you know, that when women run, they can win.
So, Julie, is that sort of consistent with what you see?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, studies have shown previously that women win at the same rates as men typically, but don't always run at the same rates. And that's really why Emily's List has been such an important part of the Democratic Party's recruiting mechanism since 1985, because our staff would spend a lot of time talking to women across their kitchen tables, you know, talking to them about why they should run, why their leadership was necessary, how to put the pieces together to make a campaign successful. And that has been a big part of our role for so long. And it still is. There are still parts of this country, rural Iowa, the panhandle of Florida, where there are vacant seats and just nobody stepping up to run. And so we are recruiting women in some of these places still, but there is undoubtedly a big change in women raising their hands and saying, I'm ready, let's do this. If this guy can be president, I can run for local office.
Dave Hopkins, I want to come back to you, because on your blog, you cite data from the Pew Research Center that suggests that antipathy to Trump is very evident among a lot of these folks who are running, right?
Well, sure. I mean, Democrats in general are very mobilized this year because of their very strong dislike of the president. And from the moment that he got elected in this somewhat surprising upset 2 years ago, there's been an energy on the Democratic side that is really a mix of anger and frustration and opposition to the Trump White House. And that's what we're seeing playing out in this election, where we see Democratic turnout in primaries is way up. There are more Democratic candidates running. The Democrats are raising more money, and where they report to pollsters that they're more enthusiastic about voting in the 2018 midterms. Mm.
So what about Republican women running for office? Are their numbers up, Dave?
A little bit, but there's nothing like the revolutionary change that we're seeing in the Democratic side. Republican women are still very much underrepresented in terms of candidate pools, just as in the past.
Right. Julie, is that consistent with what Emily's List sees? In other words, are most of the women that come to you Democrats running for office, looking to run for office?
Yes, Emily's List is an organization that only deals with Democratic women, but it is a massively one-sided year for this sort of excitement around women candidates. It's been Democratic women that have been driving turnout, but also been the ones stepping up to run for office. And as the sort of chart of number of women in Congress for Democrats has gone up, the number of women Republicans has gone down. They're going to lose a big percentage of women in their caucus just due to either running for higher office or retirements at the congressional level, and we expect them to not gain much ground at all, whereas Democratic women will add to their ranks pretty dramatically.
So one of the places that we're not seeing this so-called pink wave hit is in gubernatorial races. I'm seeing that only 16 of 61 female candidates won their primaries. Julie, any theories about why that is?
Sure. I can tell you we have hit a historic number, so I would like to just make that point that we are at a record number of women as major party nominees in gubernatorial races. But it's still difficult to break through and change the perception around women as leaders in positions like governorships. Women largely are seen to have qualities that make good legislators, but it's a glass ceiling that can be difficult to break in a lot of cases still. And that's why the women who we have seen in, say, Maine and New Mexico, who have won their primaries and are looking very good in their races for those governor seats, are such tremendously strong candidates. But it takes a lot. It's a hard paradigm to shift when it comes to executive leadership still.
Why is that, Dave, in your view? I mean, why are the numbers so much lower in these executive positions?
I think there are a couple of reasons. I think when Julie talks about how voters may think about the qualities of a legislator versus the qualities of an executive, sometimes they sort of pigeonhole women as better suited for the legislative role as being more collaborative and less decisive. But I also think that one of the things we're seeing this year is a lot of the women running for the House, including a lot of the really strong candidates, are women who have not held elective office before. You know, some of them are military veterans, some of them are attorneys, some of them are people who worked in the nonprofit world or in academia, and they're trying to make that jump. And it's easier to make the jump into the House of Representatives or a state legislature from a non-political or non-elective position. It's a little bit more of a leap to go all the way to Senate or all the way to governor in one go. And so what we may see is women who are successful in lower offices this year may be setting up gains for women in Senate and governor's races in future elections.
Julie, let me ask you about the news around Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. On Monday, he'll testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee along with Christine Blasey Ford. She alleges that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were in high school. And it brings to mind the 1991 testimony of Anita Hill, who alleged that then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her. What followed was the so-called Year of the Woman in 1992, when an unprecedented number of women were elected to Congress. Do you expect this current Supreme Court fight to have a similar effect on this election?
Well, I think women voters and candidates, but you know, we saw voters in Virginia, for example, are already so highly motivated by what they've seen coming out of the Trump administration and really positions of leadership across the board, media companies, hotel chains, you name it. And so it's been this sort of slow burn all along, this assault on women's rights and the feeling like they've been constantly under attack that really began with the election of Donald Trump, of course. And then, you know, we had the Women's March where women could see in their own communities that they weren't alone. And then that led pretty much immediately into the healthcare fight, where women were the ones making the phone calls and into their members of Congress and trying to prevent the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which was a tremendous show of activism, and it was successful in the defeat of the repeal bill. And then that sort of led right into the explosion of the Me Too movement and Time's Up, and it's been sort of one thing after another, and it's been building all along, so this will undoubtedly add fuel to the fire that many women are feeling, that this administration that is pushing through this nomination in an abnormal way to achieve a political goal of a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court is totally unacceptable.
All right. Well, that's Julie McLean Downey. She's National Director of Campaign Communications with Emily's List. She joined us from Washington. Julie, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Anthony.
And Dave Hopkins, a professor of political science at Boston College who studies American political parties and elections. Dave Hopkins, thank you as well.
Oh, anytime, Anthony.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And let's return to Lori Trahan's very narrow victory in the Democratic primary in the 3rd Congressional District in Massachusetts. It came after a chaotic election that included a crowded field of 10 candidates, then election night chaos, 2 weeks of uncertainty, and a recount. In the end, Trahan won by just 145 votes, capturing less than 21% of the vote. Some elections observers say, what a mess! And they ask, is there a better way to run an election? Yes, say advocates of ranked choice voting. In fact, they say this election is the poster child for why ranked choice voting makes so much sense. Among those advocates is Drew Penrose. He's the law and policy director for Fair Vote, a Maryland-based electoral reform organization. Drew Pence, welcome to Radio Boston. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks. Glad to be on.
Can you explain briefly how ranked choice voting works for listeners who may not know?
Absolutely. So ranked choice voting is simple. You vote in a ranked choice voting election just like any other election. You've got the name of the candidate and you mark the candidate that you like the most. However, you gain the ability to rank backup choices. So this is my first choice, but if they can't win, this is my second choice and so on. Third choice, fourth choice, however many candidates happen to be in the contest. That way, you can count up the votes, and if there's a big split among a large field of candidates, like we saw in that primary election, then the candidate in last place can be eliminated. And if your first choice is eliminated, your vote is instantly added to the votes of your next choice, rather than being wasted. And you just repeat that process. It's an instant runoff.
Basically. I see, an instant runoff, and until you get to a situation where one candidate has a majority of the votes. Is that right?
Exactly. That's right. So you get the benefits of those runoff elections, that majority rule, without the need for that second election and without the reduced turnout that we see in runoff elections. So people in general get a much stronger voice in a single decisive election.
All right. So what advantages does it have over the current system we employ? And talk specifically about that third district race that we were talking about in the first break, you know, where we had 10 candidates and after this long, complicated system and a recount and everything, Lori Trahan wins with just 21% of the vote.
Yes. And we see crowded fields every election cycle. This one has really been special. Democrats are being drawn to these primary elections, and so we're seeing it a lot in Democratic primaries. It does happen in Republican primaries as well, where a large field of candidates all decide to participate, which is a good thing, right? It shows excitement, more people having different perspectives on what governance should look like in their political parties, and a good thing for voters to have more choices. But then if they can't identify which are the two front runners, then they run into this problem where they don't know if they vote for a candidate, if that candidate has any chance of winning, will their vote wind up being wasted? You hear people express that concern sometimes. And people have to engage in a lot of strategic voting to decide who they're going to vote for. If it's very difficult to do with these larger fields, then you can wind up with a situation where a candidate wins with a low plurality, and that causes all sorts of problems. In a primary election, it can kind of undermine the goal of the party unifying around a strong nominee. If we had done a round-by-round process and seen that the winner had majority support, that candidate would go into the general election from a much stronger position.
But isn't it true, though? I mean, or correct me if I'm wrong, but with ranked choice voting, wouldn't it be possible for someone who might have finished second or third, say, in the first round of voting, could actually emerge as the winner at the end of the sort of instant runoff process that ranked voting does?
That can happen, and the fact that that's possible in a single-choice plurality election like this primary election was raises doubts as to whether the quote-unquote right candidate won. We can't really know which of the candidates would have won in a head-to-head contest when people were only allowed to express one preference. It's a lot clearer when you look at partisan races that are done this way. So Maine recently adopted ranked choice voting, and the effort for that came after a governor's election in which a Democrat and an independent split the vote, and the Republican governor, Paul LePage, currently governor of Maine, was elected with something like 38% of the vote. So that's, you know, more than 60% of voters who feel like they, in some sense, voted against that candidate, but weren't able to elect a candidate that they preferred instead. Now, whether ranked choice voting would have changed the outcome is something we can never know, but people come out of that feeling like it could have, and that's a real problem.
Let me ask you about one or two of the concerns that I've read about and just get you to respond. The sort of most basic one is that voting should be super easy. I mean, it should be really transparent. And counting, tabulating ballots should be really straightforward as well. And if you have a crowded field and you have to go into a voting booth and sort of put in order six different candidates, that's not so easy.
So this is an interesting point. This is a worry that we hear from people for whom ranked choice voting is a new idea. However, when you look at places using ranked choice voting, you know, this isn't a new idea. It's been in use now for over 100 years somewhere. And there are currently 11 cities using ranked choice voting. The state of Maine now, five more have adopted it and will be implementing it in their next election cycles. And when we see ranked choice voting in action, what we see is that voters do rank their choices. In exit polls, when they come out of the voting booth, they often say that they like ranked choice voting. In Maine, we didn't even need an exit poll because in the very same election in which they ranked their choices in the primary election, they also voted on a ballot question on whether they wanted to keep ranked choice voting for future elections. And a clear majority voted yes. So there you have people using ranked choice voting and immediately saying, yes, I like this, I want to keep using it.
Right.
So that's really what we're seeing coming out of it. The results, what I would say is when you have a split field and people feel like maybe the wrong candidate won in some sense, that can cause much more of a concern with legitimacy of the outcome than seeing a round-by-round contest. When the results are displayed in a way that's clear and comprehensible, we see that voters don't have a problem with it.
Drew Penrose, one more question. We only have about 10 or 15 seconds left, but one more question. What's the resistance to it? I mean, your challenge is to convince a pretty entrenched political system to change, and that's difficult to do, right?
That's right. Ranked choice voting is still a new idea for a lot of people. And the number one concern we hear isn't so much any complaint about ranked choice voting per se, but rather just a sort of fear that something new might have unintended consequences.
Right.
Fortunately, as momentum for ranked choice voting is moving forward, we're getting more and more data on places that are actually using it. So the figures that I was able to mention before, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico used ranked choice voting in their mayoral elections for the very first time earlier this year. And a mayoral field of six candidates, over 90% of voters ranked all six. Majority came out saying they liked it, wanted to keep using it, even wanted to extend it statewide. So the more and more places use ranked choice voting, the more familiar people get with it, the more we're seeing that those concerns are being resolved for a lot of people.
Well, Drew Penrose is the Law and Policy Director for Fair Vote, a Maryland-based electoral reform organization. He was talking about ranked choice voting. Drew Penrose, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.